Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program was brought to you by the Christmas Tree Farmers Association of New York, partnering with Grow NYC on a pilot project to make farm-fresh trees and wreaths available at green markets. For more information, visit christmastreesny.org.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you, as always, live from the back of Roberta's Pizza here in Bushwick, Brooklyn. You, of course, are listening to The Farm Report. I am your host, Erin Fairbanks. Every week on The Farm Report, we talk about the nitty-gritty of agriculture and food production. Off air, I am the executive director of Heritage Radio Network. And today, we are continuing our conversation around Christmas trees. And I am excited to be joined on the line by Lars Crooks. Lars is in a long line of Christmas tree farmers. Actually, it's interesting to learn one of the longest running Christmas tree farms in the entire country, Tuckamone Farm out in New Hope, Pennsylvania, where I will actually be spending my Christmas this year. So Lars, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So the very first tree was planted in 1929, is that right?
That is correct.
Oh, wow. So definitely lots of Christmas tree history in your family. And, you know, we've been talking on the program a little bit about the Christmas tree industry more broadly and how it impacts local agriculture infrastructure. And I wanted to chat with you about two items in particular. One, some of the really amazing conservation work that you and your family have stewarded on your farm. And two, I want to talk a little bit about farm transition because you guys have had the farm passed from a couple different generations now. I thought that might be a good place to start. When your family was thinking about stewarding the farm for the next generation, but then also handing it off from grandparents to parents to kids, can you talk a little bit about how you approach those decisions and kind of maybe things that worked really well in the past or things that maybe didn't work so well?
Well, our farm, there's a long history of actual soil preservation. Our farm is a national historic landmark in the agricultural section. So probably the most obvious thing is that two of the three fields that we have are pretty effectively contour farmed, or contour planted. So any soil disturbance, the soil is retained in the field instead of washing directly down a hill. I inherited the planting diagrams from my grandfather and have followed them, but I'm now replanting the fields and clearing out blocks and subsoiling and trying to revitalize the soil that we have there. So other than the contour farming, probably the biggest change recently in regards to soil and land use is my discontinuing use of heavy use of herbicides and fungicides and pesticides in an attempt to have a much lower impact on the surrounding environment from the Christmas tree business. So I'm not planting Douglas fir there anymore because of the amount of fungicide that we have to apply to keep them viable in this climate.
So, you know, one of the things that we have chatted a little bit about is kind of trends in trees and how folks are taught to ask for different varieties that may or may not be great varieties for that region. Why were you guys planting that type in that space if it doesn't do so well?
Well, traditionally, Douglas fir has been a very successful tree. I think primarily because it shears so well. It grows very densely, and with a little pruning and shearing, you can make a very dense tree, and your turnover is much faster with the Douglas fir than with the true firs. It grows a little slower than a pine, but faster than a spruce or a fir. So it's a profitable tree to grow. It's an attractive tree to grow. It's a fragrant tree to grow. And for quite a while, it was very successful where we are, but things have changed, and there are a couple of pathogens that come in. One of them is much harder to control than others, called Swiss needlecast, and it just requires such vigilant application of fungicide that we just decided to discontinue that variety. Rather, you know, with the scale that we grow on, it's not worth it for us.
Not worth it for you. Well, I want to just clarify for folks who may not be familiar with contour farming, what that means and what it might kind of look like if we were out in Bucks County and driving past your farm.
Well, it looks a lot like a topographical map where you have concentric gradients of lines that follow the terrain. So instead of on a hill having a line that goes perpendicular to the slope, you have a series of lines that are coarsely parallel but follow the shape of the hill, so that when water runs off, it's if you have disturbed soil, it's caught by the disturbed soil instead of creating a disturbed area that it can follow like a stream bed and erode. That was a lot of what we saw in the early and mid-20th century with heavy mechanized plowing and the lifting of the soil and destruction of the composition of the soil. Is when there was heavy rain, all the soil would just follow gravity downhill, and you'd be left with subsoil and poorer soils at the tops of the hills. So your plowing and planting technique it's almost like a network to catch soil to keep it from following the water downhill.
Now, that kind of really careful look at water management and using that to also protect your soil. I mean, water has played kind of a large role for your farm and for your family. I mean, can you talk a little bit about the Honey Hollow watershed and how Tuckamoni Farm has been part of the development of that watershed and what kind of prompted that?
Sure. Well, again, going back to soil following water and gravity downhill, my great-grandfather and other farmers in the area noticed that in heavy rains, the soils were washing off their property, and the farms downhill were noticing that their creek beds were getting silted in and overflowing because of the farming techniques. And so they got together and started talking about it and realized it was beyond their scope of expertise to try to remedy it. So long story short, they actually got together and got some federal assistance, and some real leaders in the field got together and came up with a comprehensive soil and water management plan to preserve that watershed. And it's the first watershed in the country where farmers cooperated together to preserve their resources. So we've had really three waves of conservation on our property, the first being the initial Honey Hollow project. And then as that first phase started to come to a close, my great-grandfather and some others founded the Honey Hollow Environmental Education Center. And that went from the late 60s until the late 70s into the early 80s when it became the Bucks County Audubon Society. And so our property has been used since the late 60s for environmental education to try to spread these concepts out into the youth and build up a grassroots awareness of soil and water conservation in a watershed. And Bucks County Audubon Society exists today, and members of the organization and myself reached out to a local nonprofit farming operation that's been doing organic farming in our area, and offered the 20 acres of land adjacent to our property that is owned by the Bucks County Audubon Society to them to farm organically and rebuild the soils. And the young man who's managing that farm is someone who was educated with the teachings of these leaders from the first wave. So when I turned him on to the story of Honey Hollow and showed him some of the printed material, he was really blown away that he was literally able to follow in the footsteps of people that were luminaries in his education. So it's a very exciting project that we're in right now in that regard, not directly related to trees, but related to the watershed entirely.
Yeah, well, and when you say Audubon Society, I know folks are familiar with their work, you know, with birds, and I do think it's one of the interesting things that they are such a partner to farmers and such strong advocates for conservation of agriculture space. And can you talk a little bit about, like, why that linkage happens?
I think that it was probably at that point the best partnership that the Honey Hollow Environmental Education Center could find as far as gaining capital to expand their operation. And they actually, you know, the Honey Hollow Environmental Education Center was on our property originally and really operated out of a tiny space, a loft area that was heated with a wood stove and our pole barn. And, you know, it was just a few kids, and it really grew. And the network that existed through the Audubon Society really enabled them to grow. And now it's at a point, the internet and the economy have changed so many things that the Audubon, you know, Bucks County Audubon has to adapt and come up with new programs to reach out to the community and retain interest. So I think that the organic farming operation that we're doing there should help a good bit in that regard.
Yeah, well, I think it just kind of echoes, you know, we started this conversation and we're going to circle back around to, you know, Christmas trees and this product that we engage with, many of us engage with in our homes, you know, once a year. And then very, very quickly, I mean, as we've seen just in the last 10 minutes, you know, we're all of a sudden talking about watershed and soil conservation and, you know, bird habitat preservation and community outreach and education. And I think that to me is like one of the most exciting things about thinking and like living and working in the agriculture space is that it touches like so many things. The moment you start even just kind of digging into it, there's so much there. I wonder for you, you know, if you, as you look forward to stewarding your family's farm for the next generation, what do you see as kind of the primary challenges that, you know, you're going to be facing in your lifetime to make sure that you're going to be able to hand the farm off in the future?
Well, I think that one of the things that affects us most directly is development in our area and actual wildlife management, in that the trees that are best suited to grow in our climate unfortunately are heavily browsed by deer. So I'm looking at the, you know, having to fence and manage wildlife that is very destructive to a crop that I'm trying to grow. I'm focusing on hot weather, drought tolerant conifers that are very attractive and will do well in a more hostile climate. So unfortunately, they are tier one for deer that are starving to browse on. So there's the issue of finding a suitable Christmas tree crop to continue that operation. And I also think that diversifying the different types of agriculture that we do there is going to be critical as well. In inheriting an operation that my grandfather had operated for nearly 50 years, there are fields that have been planted in the same rows for 20 or 30 years, and there's a lot of soil compaction. And because of the use of herbicides and pesticides, a lot of the vitality of the soil has been lost. So I'm in the middle of a transitional phase where I'm refreshing and replenishing the biological activity in the soil and learning about that. So improving the growing environment for the trees and choosing, if we continue with the Christmas tree operation, that a quiver of trees that are appropriate for the environment, I think, are the two biggest hurdles to deal with.
So the fact that I was skipping to work in a 60-degree day is something that is obviously impacting your planning choices for the future, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, there are trees that being able to harvest them and have them stay as a product that someone brings into their home that's attractive and doesn't drop their needles when they're still active and you know, normally this time of year all of the trees would be fairly dormant because of the temperature. It gets a little trickier. I had one complaint this year from a customer that had a variety that normally doesn't have too many issues and the tree just had not, because it's been consistently warm, had not shed its older needles yet. So once they brought it into their house, conifers are like deciduous trees in that they shed their photosynthetic their needles, you know, that they use for photosynthesis, but they don't do it as dramatically as deciduous trees. So they'll get a couple of years' use out of it, and the ones that are on the inside of the tree will then drop out when it gets cool in the autumn. So I had some people that were pretty freaked out by that, and it's directly because of the mild autumn that we've had.
Wow. It's just like a tough thing too. You're kind of like there's not too much that you can really do about it, save building a dome over the trees and creating a temperature controlled environment, I guess. And then maybe looking to some other varieties. It's so fascinating. Well, one more question before I let you go. I do want to get a little bit of a sense of So for your farm, you know, it's passing down from like generation to generation. I do want to talk a little bit about some of the infrastructure that makes those transitions possible, because I know for a lot of farms, for the kind of folks who are running the farm, it also is often their largest kind of financial asset and the thing that's going to provide them with funds to secure their, you know, life and lifestyle in their retirement and or their home or their property. So with a multi-generational farm like yours, how do those transitions work, and are there kind of like tools or support or things that your family has used that, you know, we might want to share with other folks who are similarly looking at some of these like transition issues?
Well, I think that the most effective tool that our family has used in terms of retaining the property is that there was a partnership very early on with a land preservation group, and the writing was on the wall that the area where our farm was is high value commercial real estate or residential real estate for development. I mean, the whole corridor between New York and Philadelphia is very heavily developed, and our farm was, they wanted to put Route 202 right through it, and then there would be homes sprouting up all over. So my great-grandfather had the property preserved, and there will be no development on it, and we have an agreement with the land preservation group for family use of the property until 2050. So part of it is not directly owned by our family. It was a gift that was given. So I think that now in this era, there are a lot of land preservation groups that are just making sure that farmland stays open, and there are, you know, people that can work with farmers to preserve their land and to sell off the development rights to it, and that the farmers could in turn get a cash infusion into their business that would really make a difference for them, as well as the tax offset for the donation if they choose to do that.
I lied. I do have one more final question. It was interesting in the show before us, Cherry Bomb, Radio Cherry Bomb, which is all about kind of women in the food movement. Their guest, Yana Gilbin, was talking about your big Christmas tree burning celebration that happens after the holidays. And I'm wondering if you can share a little bit about that with our guest before we let you go.
Oh, the party that I had at the end of the season?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was, I haven't had one for a couple of years. It kind of takes a lot of energy, but I had an employee ask me if we were going to have a party for the staff, and I thought, sure, that'd be fantastic. And it just kind of snowballed. Originally, I thought it was going to be intimate and ended up being almost 100 people. We were originally going to have it in the original, in our barn. And then I decided, well, we've been outside all winter. We're pretty acclimated. We'll just do it outside. So I bought some straw bales and made some sofas out of straw bales and laid out a few fire pit locations and used one of the outbuildings and had a band that, as you're in Brooklyn, I'm sure quite a few of you have heard Old Rugged Sauce that used to play at the Brooklyn Rod and Gun Club. in any event, got them to come out and play, and we just had a glorious time cooking off a bunch of different food and had a fantastic bartender and live music. We've had a couple of really excellent parties, and I think I owe everybody one coming up soon.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed. I'm willing to make the trip out to Bucks County, just saying.
Yeah.
Lars, thank you so much.
I'll let you know.
It was really great to learn a little bit more and to kind of continue our conversation on Christmas trees with you.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
Hang tight, folks. We are going to take a short break, and when we come back, we are going to continue our tree talk. We're going to bring you a special recording from some interviews I did this past Saturday at the Fort Greene Green Market. So we'll be back.
Ever wonder where your Christmas tree came from? Now you don't have to. New York State grown Christmas trees are now available in New York City. Trees grown on farms here in New York State are harvested just a few days before arriving to the city. Trees cut close to home stay fresh longer. And trees cut close to home travel less, which reduces fuel consumption of delivery vehicles. Did you know that buying a real tree helps to sustain agriculture in New York State by supporting local farmers and keeping important open space in agriculture production? The Christmas Tree Farmers Association of New York is partnering with Grow NYC on a pilot project to make farm fresh trees and wreaths available at green markets in Brooklyn, Queens, and Manhattan. So when you shop local this holiday season, you can include the tree in that list. For more information and a full list of locations, visit ChristmasTreesNY.org.
On Saturday, December 5th, I was on site at Fort Greene Green Market here in Brooklyn to learn more about locally sourced Christmas trees. While there, I caught up with their executive director, Michael Hurwitz. What follows is a discussion about Green Market's new partnership with the New York State Christmas Tree Growers Association. We talk about what this means for the state's farmers and NYC consumers.
It's the first year that we've had a partnership where they are at market. Last year, we did some research on their behalf of where there are potential opportunities in the city and where the existing Christmas tree vendors that set up everywhere are buying from to see if there was a way that we could make some connections. This year is, in fact, the first time we've actually had them at market. It's an amazing partnership. We actually have our youth market program, so we operate 16 youth-run farm stands throughout the five boroughs, and those markets close at Thanksgiving. It's a great opportunity for young people to learn more about agriculture, stay engaged, stay employed, while providing staff for Christmas tree growers that are coming down into the city. So we're working with two Christmas tree growers this year. We're here at Fort Greene, Brooklyn Borough Hall also on Saturdays, Tucker Square, which is across the street from Lincoln Center, on Thursdays and Saturdays, and Sundays in Jackson Heights.
Wow. So why do you think that it hadn't happened before now?
I think New York City is a strange foreign place to a lot of folks that live upstate.
Fair.
And,
yeah.
And making those connections, you really need someone intentionally making that happen. I also think that, you know, with Christmas trees, it's a different operation here in the city. Also, there are so many Christmas tree operators that set up. They're not from New York, and they're selling trees from Canada and from North Carolina and from Pennsylvania, and have had these businesses probably for decades, and they're well established. But this is just another great opportunity to expand our mission, you know, so create opportunities for local growers and have products, a diverse array of products for New Yorkers. So.
And I think, too, one of the things that strikes me is really thinking about non-edible agriculture products. I mean, people think about the green market as a place to go to get dinner supplies, but you guys are actually doing a lot more than that. I mean, I think I just walked by someone, beautiful like fiber rugs and blankets and that type of thing as well. I mean, how does that kind of fit into some of your like evaluation of like what you want to have at market and when?
Right. Well, I'll go back to mission. We want to create economic opportunities for growers. And for them, you know, if you're raising sheep, then of course you want to sell wool. You want to sell the lambskins. It's added economic opportunity. You're making use of a whole animal, right? And at the same time, it provides increased opportunities for New Yorkers to have locally grown products. It just expands opportunities for farmers and to throw things on the truck and to expand what we can do year-round. It's season extension, and that's really, yeah, it's fun to see because more and more farmers, I think, are thinking about getting creative. I think more opportunities are popping up for them to do some processing. And it's what we've been pushing for years, so it's nice to see that it's happening. You know, one of the things we like to say is, when you come to a green market, you're able to meet the producers that are there, and you're able to get a different type of education. So going back to like thinking that Christmas trees are just trees that are out there, they grow. You don't realize that there's a process behind it, that they actually are beneficial in various ways. And you heard Charles to describe them, and you can talk to the grower and understand what are the different varieties and why does it matter and why is it important.
Yeah,
that's cool.
One such grower you can chat up at market is Charles Hurd, a seventh generation farmer in New York State's Hudson Valley. I talked with Charles about how the Hurd family farm came to grow Christmas trees, along with some of the benefits of trees to both their farm system and consumers.
My name is Charles Hurd. I'm a seventh generation farmer from the Hudson Valley, New York. Our home farm is in Clintondale. We are currently standing in a Penske truck loaded with Christmas trees at Fort Greene in Brooklyn.
So I'm guessing this is maybe not where you normally spend your Saturdays.
No. Normally we spend our Saturdays in the orchard or in the packing house where we produce apples and also make wreaths from our Christmas trees to sell to people at our farm.
So how did you end up down at Fort Greene?
We were contacted by the Christmas Tree Growers Association, and in conjunction with the green markets, they were looking to get more local Christmas trees into the green market system. So we were approached, and we thought that it was a great idea that we had a bumper crop of trees, and it was another outlet. And it was a great way to get closer to our customers.
Yeah, for sure. So, seventh generation farmer, has your family always done Christmas trees, or is there like most is probably an evolution, I'm guessing?
Well, yes. Well, the farm started out like most farms do, that had a little bit of everything. We had a sawmill, and there's chickens, few apple trees, currants, grapes. And about 35 years ago, the Christmas tree operation was started to provide for my sister and myself for our college fund. And it was another outlet to reach the consumer in the off season. That other than just having apples.
Just having apples, yeah. It's interesting. Actually, like, trees, I feel like, are often an investment for college funds, whether it's, like, planting a forest when your kids are born, if you're, like, in that type of region.
Yeah. It seems that it costs a college fund to grow them and get them prepared for market. and it's very difficult. The margins are very slim on trees. But they provide a lot of benefits, the open space, small trees that produce a lot of oxygen, and they have a lot of benefits of opening up our markets to be year-round.
Well, we were talking with Mary Jean last week about kind of some of the benefits of for consumers of like buying Christmas trees that are local to your region. But I'm wondering, looking at like your farm operation and thinking about agriculture more generally, like is that the main benefit of trees is like the provision of open space and then like extending of markets? But are there other benefits like that, like to the land or to
There are huge benefits to the land. One is that it provides habitat, that it's also a very low spray, not intensive crop. And the benefits also range to psychologically in the winter. It's nice to have a living thing inside your home, and it
yeah.
really helps to set the mood. And it can be pretty depressing during the winter, and I think Christmas trees and living green, it helps psychologically to get through that time of the season.
Yeah, I would totally agree with you. Actually, I had like not even really thought about that. Well, so it looks like there's a couple different kinds of trees that you have here today. How did you kind of make decisions around what was like the right fit for your operation?
Well, it's very difficult because it takes about 7 years to get a tree to consumer size. So the decisions were made a long time ago, and we kind of erred on the side of caution, and we planted a little bit of everything. So we do have some trees that don't go as well as others, and we rethink replanting them. But you have to kind of look at what the trend is, you know, see what the demography is and who's buying trees, what type of trees, how large are the ceilings in their house, where do they live, what are their, you know, buying habits and how much are they willing to spend. And all that needs to go into it when looking to plant a Christmas tree.
Yeah, I'm like, what size tree can fit in the back of the Uber driver who's going to take me home after market?
That's right, yeah.
I would ideally love to get a much bigger tree, but I don't know how I'm going to transport it.
Yeah, not everybody has a box truck to carry the Christmas trees, so we know we're dealing with that size restriction. So we need to think about differently for when we're coming down to Brooklyn versus our consumers in upstate New York, where we're located, are a lot of times looking for the largest possible tree that they can find.
That's how it was at my house. We're like, can we be bigger than the Joneses this year? For
That's
sure.
Right.
So, you know, obviously you guys have a wreath out there. And so can you talk a little bit about kind of the source material for putting like wreaths together and garland and the process for that and how that is different than like the trees?
The wreaths are a value-added product to Christmas tree growing, and they allow you to take what would otherwise be waste material and turn it into a value-added product that you can sell, that is something that is nice coming into your home and has that nice smell. And also, people only purchase one Christmas tree per household, so it gives you another outlet to make an additional sale.
To make an additional sale. And then where are you getting the actual, like, pieces of tree that go into?
Sometimes the deer will ruin the bottom of a tree, or maybe there'll be some mechanical injury through tractor or for any other reason. So oftentimes what we'll do is we'll cut trees off kind of in the middle, so we can take the greens on the bottom of the tree so that we're not wasting those greens, and it allows the top of the tree to have a nicer shape and be a little more attractive.
One of the things we were chatting about before we turned the mic on was edible products from the tree. Is there anything that we can eat off of a Christmas tree that you'd recommend?
I would not. I couldn't recommend it, but I'm sure if it was Googled, there's plenty of uses for Christmas trees. The gum of the sap was used. Also, you know, there's bark, which people can eat if they are starving in the woods and they need to get certain nutrients. Huh. But I wouldn't suggest it because we have, especially at the Green Market here, so many other great alternatives.
To learn more about the New York City Green Markets, visit grownyc.org. Additional info about New York State Christmas Tree Growers Association can be found at christmastreesny.org. For more programs like this, check us out at heritageradionetwork.org. All right. Well, as you can tell, I was a little stuffed up in that recording, so thanks for hanging with us. It is now time for our Escape Maker segment. And you might think when I say Castello di Borghese that we were heading possibly to somewhere outside of the Northeast region, but we're actually just taking you on a little trip to Long Island, and we are on the line with Giovanni, who's going to tell us a little bit more about Castello and what you guys do out there. Welcome to the show, Giovanni.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So first and foremost, let's start with the name. Can you tell us where the name came from?
Yeah, absolutely. The name refers to my father's noble lineage going back to a small town just outside of Florence. It actually goes a little further back before that. Originates in Sicily and eventually to a small town called San Marco outside of Florence, where my father was born and his siblings, and later they all moved to Rome, and eventually my father to Philadelphia, where he met my mother and had my sister and I, of course. So the real significance of the name was back about 8 generations ago.
Wow!
It was exactly we had a pope in our family, and he was in power during the time that the basilica was destroyed, and so now everything in that time that was built in that time features the Borghese name on it. So if you go to the Vatican City and see St. Peter and look at the center of the St. Peter's Church itself, it says Borghesius. And, of course, we've heard of the Borghese Gardens and Galleria Borghese. These are all things that came about during that era when that family, had its rule, if you will. If we were all still living in noble times, it would have a lot more, significance in present time. But really, it's something that my father was always very humble about and didn't really, get talked about much, but it was always a part of our family. So the title of prince, if you will, followed him, and my mother and father were always referred to as Prince and Princess Marco and Anne-Marie Borghese.
Wow. So fast forward to 2015 and making wine in Long Island. Still a royal affair. Give us the lowdown.
Sure, absolutely. So 2015 was an excellent harvest. We're making all sorts of wines out here on the North Fork of Long Island. We Borghese feature 4 reds and 3 whites, Cabernet Franc, Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, and the very rare Pinot Noir. And for the whites, it's a Riesling, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. And with those 7 grapes, we make about 20. From year to year, it's either between 17 and 20 wines, and that'll just depend on whether we're making blends or if we have estate level as well as reserve level wines for each of those grapes. Some rosés we make, for example, as well as a dessert wine. These all lead to the different number of exactly how many wines we have on hand at all times, but yeah, we're doing amazing things. Different vineyards in the area feature different grapes. Some are grown easier than others, depending on the specific region and soil. But for the most part, what you'll find out here is typically a French varietal.
Wow. So, I mean, obviously, because you guys are a Escape Maker endorsed destination, I know that folks like myself here in Brooklyn and from other spots around the Northeast are in for a treat if they head your way. What types of stuff do people do when they come out to visit? I mean, other than obviously drinking a lot of different wines.
Sure, absolutely. So there are really a lot of things to do out here on the North Fork of Long Island. It's a very small, dense region. So the idea of if you're into wine solely, the idea of going from vineyard to vineyard, tasting wine, and coming across one you love, narrowing down your search to find out what vineyard is really your favorite vineyard. This is something that's very easy to do. You can go to many vineyards in one day. If you devote a whole weekend out here, you know, 2 days of just vineyard hopping, you'll definitely find something you like before long. And, you know, of course, outside of the vines, the vineyards themselves, we have strawberry picking, apple picking, goat cheese farms, sheep farms, all sorts of different types of livestock and fruits and vegetables, a lot of organic vegetable farms. It's really, you know, the wineries will always say, you know, the region will be known for like a blend of everything. You know, we can argue that the wineries bring the region a whole lot of attention, but if we call it just a wine region on its own, it's not necessarily true. There's really so much out here that one would enjoy doing in a given weekend. And if I can add one more thing, I would say don't forget the restaurants and the accommodations. Every restaurant out here is a farm-to-table restaurant featuring local ingredients, and the accommodations are very quaint, small B&Bs, taking small groups at a time. We have some larger scale motels, and of course hotels are about 20 minutes away in Riverhead. And so with all this considered, it's easy to imagine what a weekend out here would entail.
Yeah, no, it's like kind of interesting. It's like an Italian family, French grape varieties in the U.S. So it sounds like a very like all American story.
Yeah, we like to joke that we have a bit of a split personality. when you come to the actual tasting room, there's a terracotta flooring with big cast iron gates and large windows. Everything is big, and we've been told it has a Spanish feel to it. So,
hey,
when you consider all these pieces together, it certainly can make you ask questions.
So, thinking about Long Island as a wine producing region, I mean, one of the things, of course, we talk about a lot on the show is development pressure and the importance of keeping land in agriculture. And I know that's something that you face out in Long Island with increasing intensity. And I'm just wondering, are you guys involved with land conservation efforts or local land preservations? Or how do you make sure that the land will be able to stay in vineyard production?
Sure. So I know the town does really a whole lot to do what they can do on the from a town's point of view. They've implored 5-acre zoning, and outside of that, I don't know how to speak too much on exactly what it is the town's doing to prevent development. But I know that they're an agricultural minded bunch, right? And they, I think, for the most part, don't want to see this place become development after development. But really, what it stems down to is the individual land owner, and they have to first want to protect the land and keep the landscape that the North Fork is currently known for too. So, I'm proud to say that it would break my heart to see a development go on this particular farm. It will never happen on this particular farm, but I think it comes from the landowner first, because if someone had that interest, unless the town, you know, finds a way to be for or against it, obviously this is how things of that nature are decided on, and that's how you start to see change. So we can only just kind of hope and pray that everybody wants to see as little change as possible in that regard, and, you know, that's the only way it's going to guarantee that it doesn't change.
Well, I would say if folks want to be part of protecting that in the long term, the best way I can think of is to go out and visit, and definitely folks can find you. It's just castellaborghese.com or kind of trips through Escape Maker, and then you get a delicious trip and wine and food and all of the great stuff you mentioned, and you're kind of helping support great regional agriculture. It's like such a win-win, you know?
Absolutely. And also for efforts as your current effort in getting me out there and allowing me to share with everyone what the North Fork really has to offer. We're all doing this together, so thank you.
Awesome. Thank you, Giovanni. It's been wonderful getting to chat, and hopefully we will see you out in the North Fork. We'll make a little pilgrimage. We'll do a little Brooklyn to Long Island tour, you know? We can trade spots.
We know. We have every wine open and available by the tasting, as well as estate tours. I think you'd really have a good time.
Awesome. Cool.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you out there for listening. This has been another episode of the Farm Report. As you know, we are a member-supported organization, so if you believe in the work that we're doing, now is the time. We are trying to raise $100,000 for the Heritage Radio Network by December 31st. We are a 501c3 nonprofit. Your donation is tax-deductible, so throw us a couple bucks. www.heritageradionetwork.org. Click the beating heart. Select the Farm Report so I know that you heard about giving through this show, because I would love to give you a shout out and a personal thank you. In the meantime, stay up on everything that's going on with Heritage. You can follow us on Twitter. We are Heritage_Radio. I am Erin_Fairbanks. Thank you so much for listening. Stay tuned in.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.